It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. If I told you that it is now a crime to be poor in America, you might call me crazy. It isn't, technically, against the law to be poor, but our system of fees and fines for minor crimes and traffic offenses strikes those in poverty much more often than those who are not, turning our jails into poorhouses. We'll be talking about the criminalization of poverty this hour on The Morning Show. Do you see poverty being criminalized in America? Have you experienced this yourself? Where do you see this happening? And what policy changes do you think we need to make in order to keep this from continuing? And can we make them? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Peter Edelman, a professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown Law Center. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman, welcome to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
You've been researching and studying poverty for a long time. What turned your attention to this specific aspect of the overall issue?
In a word, Ferguson, what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, beyond the killing of Michael Brown, the young man who was killed by a police officer, unarmed. But we found out there, I think America, or many people, found in Ferguson also that little city was running its, getting its money to run the city by arresting its own residents, and probably some people who wandered in too, on all kinds of misdemeanors and violations with very, very high fines and fees, and just hitting them over and over again, and when they couldn't pay, in many cases, throwing them in jail. It seems incredible, but it was absolutely true. And this is not something that, in all the work that I've done on poverty over a very long period of time, that really I was aware of. And yet we found out after Ferguson kind of opened up our eyes that it was going on all over the country. And the reason is because starting in the 80s in the Reagan period and continuing to this day, that we really have an anti-tax rebellion going on, but quite a successful one when the Congress passes a terrible bill to make the rich richer. So that's how I really got into it. There were lawyers and others who were pushing back on these things, but it hadn't become nationally known and still really isn't as much as it should.
Well, the idea that poverty is being criminalized is at the core of your book. But can you give us some examples outside of Ferguson where and how you see this playing out today? What does this look like?
Well, it looks like various things. You know, the biggest thing nationally and in Wisconsin included, and on so many of these things, the parts of the country that one might have thought wouldn't be happening, whether it's Massachusetts or the state of Washington and so on, it's about taking away people's driver's licenses. More than half of what's going on with regard to hitting people with these very high fines and fees, and when people can't pay, the amount owned just goes up and up. And it's big business. In the country, there are 10 million people who owe a total of $50 billion from all the various things, whether it's the driver's license suspensions and what goes with that, or debtor's prison for other things. But also, people get charged for once they get in the system. They have to pay to go on probation in many places. They have to pay, actually, for being in jail or prison. And so it's big, big, big business. So that's an overall thing. I'll give you one example of somebody in terms of the kind of thing like Ferguson. This is in Georgia, but it's also in other parts of the country. That there was a man named Adel Edwards, just to give you a very specific thing, from Pelham, Georgia, and he has a significant intellectual disability, and he can't read and write. Nonetheless, he was fined $500 for burning leaves without a permit, and another $528 for so-called probation, which it wasn't, for a for-profit company that they have down in Georgia and in 13, 12 other states. So that kind of thing happens really by the thousands all over the country. Usually for that kind of thing, maybe in a smaller jurisdiction, a more rural area. But the driver's license suspensions are basically everywhere.
Well, and if you can't drive, it's really hard to go to work.
It is. And what happens there, as you're just implying, you do drive. Many people do drive. They take the chance. And so what happens is that they get arrested again. And so that's a new violation. That's one of the ways, very clever, shall we say, of the authorities. Another fine. And by the way, there are fees that are associated with these things. You know, we say fine and fees, it comes nicely off the tongue. These are things, the fees part of it, are things that have nothing to do with whatever the person is supposed to have been done. So, for example, the law library in the courthouse is paid for in many places in the country by these fees, and many, many other things. That Oklahoma, for example, has 15 kinds of fees that get attached to the fines, with nothing to do with the conduct that started the whole thing.
Well, and then there are penalties attached for not making a payment, and then interest on top of that. And we haven't even brought up the issue of bail, which you cover in your book. A lot of times people there's just this cycle of constant incarceration and more fees. They're charged a daily fee for being in jail.
That is correct. So the way one can get caught in this mess, money bail is one of the ways, one of the important things. And there are problems about money bail that go beyond this terrible problem. Just in general, when people, low-income people, are arrested for anything in so many parts of the country, they're where they're absolutely going to show up. They're not a risk for anybody, and they have to pay, or they're supposed to pay, $500 or $1,000 in bail. They can't do it. That pushes them into, if they want to get out, pushes them into pleading that they did it when they didn't, and then they owe this money, and then there's a payment plan. And as you said, when they can't pay on the payment plan, no matter how it got started in the first place, when a person can't pay, there's a bench warrant, and they get brought in again. And that's the new violation there, is criminal contempt. So one way or another, whether it's more driving when you've already been suspended, or you have the payment that you haven't paid and you have a new crime from that, that's why it's such a huge thing all over the country.
But isn't, some of this has been adjudicated. There was wasn't there a Supreme Court decision, Bearden, I think it was, that should have taken care of some of this?
Yes, and there's no question that there are courts, particularly municipal courts, and this is an issue that you have in Wisconsin, where the courts are, the judges are often not lawyers in state after state. I've looked at this, and 60-70% of the those judges aren't lawyers, or there are people who maybe they're a lawyer who does something else, real estate or something. And then there are people who are just downright mean. And so they know what the law is, and they say, and I've got lots of stories of these, the judge says, well, you got a tattoo, or you're able to, so you got this nice tattoo, you're able to pay, or you got a nice pair of sneakers, so you're able to pay. Therefore, if you're not paying, that's willful, you can go to jail, and I'm not violating, says the judge, that Supreme Court case. But there's a lot of stuff that isn't currently unconstitutional, but it's getting there. And I'm talking about money bail, where just in the last year or two, we have a number of cases around the country that challenge the constitutionality of money bail as it's applied to people who can't pay for the mail, for the bail. And that's the same principle as Bearden, but it's never been in the process in the courts now. There's a terrific decision in Houston, Texas, Harris County, that declared their whole system down there unconstitutional. That's now in the appellate court there. And so that's an area that we're getting into that's extremely important and hadn't been litigated in the past.
We're talking about the book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America, with its author, Peter Edelman. And with you, if you decide to join us here at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think about all of this? And Peter, when we come back, what I'd like to talk about is what it says about us as a society, that for so many people, to be poor in 2017 is to live under the constant threat of incarceration for no other reason than being poor. What does that say about us as a society? I want to. We'll take a short break when we come back. We've got some callers who want to join us. We'll take those as well. Let's think about this. What do you think? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. Peter Edelman is my guest. You can join us as well. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of WPR. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Morning Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking with Peter Edelman, author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, about the criminalization of poverty in America and what can be done about it. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, the Ideas Network Facebook page, or Twitter. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. All great ways for you to get in touch and make your views known. What does it say about us as a society, Peter, that we have come to the point where, as you say, we have made it a crime to simply be poor in this country?
It's one response to that is that we've always had that. As you go back in the centuries, Elizabethan England, probably biblical times, where there just seems to be among some people, a feeling that if somebody is poor, it's their own responsibility, that one way or another they'd been lazy or dependent or just didn't try. And so we hear that now to some degree at all times. And I think right now, in terms of particularly nationally, more of it. On the other hand, we should be clear that our public policies, starting in the 1930s with Social Security and the New Deal, and then again in the 60s with all the efforts that were there, and between 1959 to 1973, we cut poverty in half from 22% down to 11%. So we've done things, and it's because of public policies that we have that are, that work, whether it's Social Security or food stamps or earned income tax credit or other things. And those things are being attacked right now as we're talking right now, and they're based on a premise that these things did not work. When they do, we would have twice the same, twice the number of people who are poor. It would be 90 million people instead of the 43 million that we have. Too high there, but it would be twice as much. So we ought to be clear that what we've been doing, that these statements, that what would the policies that we have don't work, are that's absolutely wrong, and we're hearing it too much. So we have done, and the problem, that certainly there are attitudes about people that are shown by the what we're talking about today, but the fact is that the bigger question in our country is that we've turned into a low-wage country, And so there's so many people who are working very hard as they can, and they're still in poverty or near poverty. If you look at up to twice the poverty level, so you're talking about over 100 million people, that's $40,000 a year for a family of three would be included in that. 103, a third of our people. So the real fundamental question that we have that we're not attacking is how many low-wage jobs that there are. And 70% of the income of people whose income is below the poverty line are working as much as they possibly can. So there's a lot of myth out there. There's in the vernacular that we hear now, fake facts that we're hearing about poverty. And so we really do need to push back and say these are not some different set of people. These are people who go, in many, many cases, most cases, in and out of poverty, and we don't have the support strong enough for them to help them stay out of poverty. And so all of this, we just need a better public focus on it and then getting to different results in the decisions that we make in our government and our public policies.
Let's take some phone calls. A lot of people are interested in this topic, as we suspected they would be. Jacqueline is with us in Slinger. You'll be first. Jacqueline, go ahead.
Yes, first quick comment. I feel like talking to some of these people that I'm living in a Dickinsonian novel. But my main point was many states now are passing laws that if you owe a fine or fee to the government, that they're removing your right to vote. So you can't even fight back through your government by petitioning your government because you no longer have a right to vote. You're no longer a citizen of the United States if you have a outstanding traffic fine.
Thanks for the call. Is that actually true, Peter Adelman? Are people losing their citizenship?
Not their citizenship, and generally speaking, we'd be talking about felonies rather than misdemeanors on that particular point. But there are 45,000 laws across the country, state and local and federal for that matter, collateral consequences as a question. You know, I think the mythology in generally is if you paid your time, then you get another chance. Well, it doesn't work that way. If you have especially a felony and you get on out, you have difficulty getting a job, you are not allowed to live in public housing, and oftentimes in many states they do lose their ability to vote, as the caller says. So we should look at it. That's important. He's absolutely right. But we need to look at all of these collateral consequences and really, in some cases, of course, some kinds of areas where a sex offender, something like that. But overall, it's vastly too much of people stuck really in poverty for the rest of their life because whatever they did stays with them in the form of these collateral consequences.
Thanks for that call. 800-642-1234. We'll go to Pete in Wautoma next. Pete, thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Yeah, there's a number of flaws in this author's theory. First of all, if you're living in poverty and you want to extract yourself from a low-paying job, learn a trade or a skill or get an education. With regards to the criminality of being poor, our justice system, we catch criminals that commit criminal acts. It isn't just a crime to be poor. And we can thank the Obama administration for creating a class of citizens that are dependent on the government for a handout. And a lot of these people supplement their income by selling drugs, committing burglaries, and committing thefts.
All right, Pete. Thanks for the call, Peter Adelman.
Well, that's what we hear in terms of the question you asked me before. In terms of the just painting with a very broad brush on the first point that they should just get a trade and get an education and so on and so on. The fundamental point here is that we have a labor market that is broken, and that we have an enormous number of lousy jobs and not enough good jobs. Sir, everybody has a responsibility to do the best that they can in terms of their education and so on. And the statement with that broad kind of generalization should actually understand the struggles that people make every day to have the best job that they can get, to do the best for themselves that they can, and not paint with that broad brush about everyone. Now, the other thing about, we have crimes. Yes, we have crimes. We need to have a criminal system that's fair. There are people who should be in prison. There are people who do things. We have to protect ourselves. We need to have a community that where one can be safe in one's home and on the street and in our communities. But we need to go through in every state. This is necessary, and we're beginning to do it, particularly in the state of California with Proposition 47 that was done by the voters of the state to say, look, these sentences in many cases are too, whether it's three strikes and you're out, as far as more in the felony side, but also misdemeanors in many, many cases shouldn't be crimes at all. And so before we say we just ought to put anybody who does a crime into prison, it's just completely ignores that the whole system needs a strong going through and getting rid of offenses that shouldn't be crimes at all, and we should have the proper sentences for the things that we do need to have. Then we can talk about whether people, whether it's fair or not, and then it would be fair.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us, which is what Paul from Eau Claire did. Here's what Paul has to say. Why is criminalization of poverty inherently wrong if it benefits good people and punishes bad behavior?
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Can you kind of translate that for me?
Well, I'll make an attempt. What it sounds like Paul is saying is that, okay, if people have bad behavior and they're poor, well, they should be punished,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing inherently wrong with that, and it benefits good people who don't do bad things.
Yes,
apparently.
Well, that's, I think, similar to Pete's
right.
The earlier statement, and the basic point is correct in a civil society. We have a need to have a system of punishing people who do things that should be punished. That's straightforward. The question is, what are we actually doing it that way? And the answer is, unfortunately, we are not. Also, by the way, we haven't talked about this, but there's also a disproportionality in terms of race in all of this, So if you look at who actually gets stuck, going back to our original question about driver's license suspended, with these fines and fees that we've been talking about, state after state, municipality one after another, disproportionately the people who get hit with these things, whether they're African American, whether they're Latino, whether they're Native Americans. And that's not an accident. Unfortunately, that is the way in which the laws that we have, which in and of themselves are overly harsh, and in many cases they're there for the purpose of collecting money, because the taxes that ought to be collectible, the politics don't allow them to do that. And then people get stuck. Secondly, if they happen to be disproportionately a person of color. And I also want to say, I don't know if we have if we were going to get to this, but in my book I talk about other forms of criminalization of poverty. When we send kids, as we do now all over the country, something very minor happens in school, and instead of deciding about it in the principal's office, they get sent to court, and they get a record, and then the collateral consequences can stick with them for the rest of their lives. So So there's that. There's the way we deal with the homeless, the way we deal with a woman who, and this happens in Wisconsin, person calls 911. There's an ordinance that's called a chronic nuisance. The police said, well, you've called too many times because even though what you're calling about is you're at risk of domestic violence, and the police say, well, you've had your three calls, and the police tell the landlord to kick the person out to evict them. Again, this is a form of criminalization of poverty. So it's not just about the fines and fees. In fact, it goes across to a large number of other things.
800-642-1234, the number to call. We're talking with Peter Edelman about his book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Let's go to Green Bay next. Anne is on the phone with us. Anne, good morning.
Hello. Well, the last caller and the last emailer, I'm just saddened by the ignorance. I really am. I mean, we do not have a criminal justice system. We have an injustice system that is criminal. And this is an abomination on humanity. And if people really understood how this works, they should be up in arms because it is just awful. People don't understand what happens when you get into the system and you don't have money. And debtor's prison, that's been abolished, but we still have a debtor's prison, and this basically just is a Jim Crow law. That's all it is.
And thanks for that call. Peter Edelman?
Well, that is certainly summarizes what I'm writing about in the book, and we really need to get through people like the caller. We just need more people to stand up and say that this is unfair. What we're doing, we're making it. It's tough enough already with people whose incomes are very low. And to push them into court debt that they can't ever pay, it just seals it makes them poor if they weren't, and if they are, it just makes it clear that they will continue to be poor. So I thank the caller.
Let's take another call. This time it's Jeff in Madison. Jeff, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm essentially calling just to respond to the previous caller, but the previous caller before her, regarding how apparently easy it is to just obtain an education. I have a master's degree, and it was in a field that was previously one of the fastest growing industries, which is to say the environmental industry, before the economic collapse, and subsequently those were the first programs cut. Nevertheless, the point is, it's not easy to just go out and get an education. And even if one were to do so, you don't necessarily have the job placement there. It doesn't necessarily relate. It's a contributing factor to this criminality, the persecution of criminals and the poor. At the same time, I'm riddled with debt. I have a master's degree, and I mean, I don't have a criminal record per se, but it gets incredibly frustrating to hear people say, just go out and get an education. You know, I've seen the ramifications of what that can do. And that's basically my end.
Okay. Jeff, thank you. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Jeff saying, you know, basically, Professor, you said this earlier. I mean, the economy is broken. And even if you get training and get an education, there may not be a job for you. And that's just kind of the way it is.
Well, it shouldn't be the way it is, because we have not, and I have to say this more broadly than about one political party or the other. This has been an enormous problem, which we really haven't faced up to it. Starting in the 1970s, the deindustrialization, and of course Wisconsin knows that, and across the Rust Belt and other parts of our country, where people in the past, in the after World War II and on into the 1970s, somebody who hadn't graduated high school could get a job in a manufacturing plant and be part of the middle class, and their kids could get to go to college when they had not, and It was really a terrific time in that period of time after World War II, the 25 to 30 years after that. And then we all know those good jobs went away, and indeed the good jobs now are jobs that require tremendous education, and even so, there aren't enough of those good jobs. And so to just say, well, it's somebody that lazy, I mean, you know, here is the man who just called, he's in a position, and he knows this very well, that there are literally millions of people like him. And it's why there is and was in the last presidential election so many people who were so angry, because the politics have finally caught up to us, and we haven't done enough to build the better jobs and also to various ways. You know, if we had we do have health coverage broader, although that's now threatened, but things like help with child care, help with housing, ways to get income in effect to go up, to increase, to add to the low wage, at least people would be in a better position. But we're not having that adequate public discussion.
We will be taking more of your phone calls. The phones are full right now. We'll try to get to everybody before the end of the hour. We're talking with Peter Adelman, professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center of Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown Law Center. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. We will take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. John Munson here on the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. Poverty is becoming a crime in America. That's the premise of Peter Adelman's new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor. We have the author with us this hour to talk about the issues that he is raising in his book. Let's start with another phone call. And Nicole is with us in Milwaukee. Nicole, thank you.
Hi. I just want to make a comment on the man who called earlier talking about the broad spectrum. That man is so wrong, and that thought process is so wrong. And that even I got an email right after him. The whole thought that poor people create economy imbalance and that people shouldn't vote and stuff like that, or their criminal past should have to do that, it's just wrong. And that man who came on there, poor people didn't do this. Obama didn't create this issue. That man said that it was Obama's fault that he created these entitlements and stuff like that, and that's not true, because everybody knows that, especially where I live, the police racially profile you. They will stop you for nothing. They will stop you for anything and just ask you for your ID, even if there's no proof that you've actually committed anything or done anything. So for that man to say, like, oh, well, like, this is all created because of this, that's wrong. And I'm really tired of people trying to blame Obama, considering the fact that Obama no longer is in office anymore, and the president that we do have in office isn't actively trying to correct the problem either. In fact, he's doing the exact opposite. Now, we are saying, like, when I say us poor people, because I do consider myself like on the lower end of the spectrum, where I just can't go out and just get an education to get a better job. And I do, and I am blessed to have a decent job right now. But there's so many other people out there who don't, and it's not easy just to go back and get a job. That's not an immediate result. You know, that takes time, that goes to school, that takes money, it takes studying, it takes a lot of work. And for people to say, like, oh, well, you should have did that. Okay, well, thank you, but what you need to do is you need to help us. You need to rally and get people. But I can understand why they don't, because it's not for their interest. You know what I mean?
Nicole,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I wanted to thank you for your call and give our guests a chance to respond to what you've said, because there's quite a bit there to chew on. Peter Adelman?
Well, the point of this caller and the earlier caller who was talking about his master's degree, but in her case, I think it's more widespread. She has a job. That's fortunate, but she obviously knows people and is aware of what the real world is like out there now, and it's the combination of what has happened in terms of good jobs in our country and everything that has to go with it so that people can have an adequate income. And so I just think it's important to say we need that public discussion. We need a different politics that results in people in office who really believe, understand that the real problems are and how we can be helpful for people to have a fair chance in our country. That's really, really the heart of it. And we've had, again, just yesterday in the United States, instead of saying that we're going to be honest about what it takes to do the things that we need to do, we've had essentially the opposite of giving the rich more than they much help with not paying taxes when they don't need that help. And indeed, the people who do need help, we should be investing in them and their children's possibilities instead of being essentially continuing to say that having the revenue that we need to do the things that we need to do as a country is a good thing and a positive thing that should be done in a fair way.
Nicole, thanks so much for your call this morning. Let's go to Richard in Mount Horeb next. Richard, hello. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning to you both. So I do agree with your guess that the anti-tax movement, you know, definitely has hurt society and the economy is certainly unbalanced. But, you know, I want to point out that fines are not just for retribution or even revenue, but they're also for deterrence. You know, in the town I live in, for example, people race up and down through my neighborhood at twice the speed limit going to work or coming home from Madison. Of course, and you know, and even when there's my five-year-old holding a sign saying "Please slow down," they just kind of look at you, smile, sometimes flip us the bird. You know, I mean, people, human beings need deterred, and I wonder what ideas your guest has to bring that about. Now, and there is a difference between criminal contempt and civil contempt. Now, you know, there's more than a few persons who don't pay their fines either because they don't think they need to or just living beyond their means. Actually, that's the American way in my mind. But, you know, maybe rather than civil contempt, allow states and munis to intercept a much larger percentage of wages than they're allowed to now until the fine's paid. I mean, that might be an answer rather than just throwing these people and holding them in contempt. And as far as
Richard, let me ask you, what if that person doesn't have a job to begin with? If there's no wages, how do you take them?
Well, okay, so if there's no wages, then they need to come to court and present evidence supporting that. You just can't not go to court and think that the judge will automatically, oh yeah, well obviously he's not coming to court because he doesn't have a job. I mean, judges aren't clairvoyant. You know, you need to go in and give that evidence. And if that's the case, fine. Don't throw them in jail for direct civil contempt because there is no contempt. They've come to court. They've done their duty. But have that lien follow them through. And the first $100 they make, $50 of it goes to the municipality.
Richard, thanks for the call. Peter Edelman?
Well, the caller makes an important point. I go out on my street and yell at people who drive too fast and people who speed, people who endanger people, people who hurt people in their driving, and a lot of other things in our society. We need to have laws, criminal laws, whether they're misdemeanors, but we need some things that are on the low end, and then there are things that we have to punish that are even more serious. So we can't just say, oh, they get a free pass. He's absolutely right. And when people scoff laws who owe the money and can pay the money should do that. And they should not just be able to walk around. By the way, we should be saying that about corporate criminals as well, but that's maybe a separate conversation. But people who can't pay doesn't mean they should get off free. That's a very important point. If it is a just law, and we do need to look at the underlying laws about whether they're appropriate or not appropriate, the man that I talked at the top of the story, if the caller was on, who was fined $500 for burning leaves without a permit, and about the same amount for phony probation. Those things should not be happening. But for a fine, for a proper law with proper fees and a person can't pay, they shouldn't. You don't just say, oh, goodbye, you get out. There are a number of things. One is we can offer community service. Won't work for everybody because some people have jobs that are take a lot of so much of their time, but we should offer it, and that's one thing. Secondly, there can be payment plans that fit with a person's income, so that at least it's saying you're being responsible for what you did, and we will collect on a level that you're able to pay, but you will pay. And so to just say, and I was not saying, and I trust that at least I can say this now, we need to be very clear that this is not so simple. But we need to clean up what we have, because the system that we have now is not just. It hauls in people for things that should not be crimes at all. It hauls in people in a differential way in terms of race and color. All of these things need to be taken into the analysis, and when we get the simplification we should have of the system, then when there are low-income people who have done something which should be punished, then it should be punished in an appropriate way.
Are we starting to see a movement away from the kind of criminalization of poverty that you write about? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? And if we see a light, is it a train?
Well, yes, is the answer. We have a long way to go, in part because as to the things that that relate to money, state after state, municipality after municipality, they bit into the poisonous apple. You know, they're addicted to the money, and it's not easy to get it through an appropriate tax policy, as we know. So we're up against that. So in California, for example, where license suspensions were amazingly awful, they had 4 million people over a 10-year period. One out of six adults in California had their licenses taken place, and it was just terrible for people because they were arrested over and over again, and then they didn't put them in jail in California, but they sure did get their garnish their wages, and they sure did have their tax refunds kept not paid to the people, and so on and so on. So gradually California has moved away from that because people advocated, leaders in the legislature have acted, and they're now moving in the right direction. And we're seeing, in terms of money bail, litigation around the country and reforms in localities, good work going on in Milwaukee, for example, on money bail. And so we see changes on that to make it much more fair in a number of places in the country. And so I think we are headed kind of state by state. There's a bill pending right now in Massachusetts that's passed both houses of their legislature to do. It's a 150-page bill to change things in their criminal justice system and make it more fair. And so we do see that. I think that the chief justices around the country are leading the way on these things. You have legislators, you have lawyers who do this. We have journalists who've done a terrific job in bringing these things much more publicly visible. And so we've got a long way to go, but I think we really are much more conscious as a country, beginning to be, and certainly in relation to mass incarceration, which this is really part of, we're seeing changes and momentum on the bigger questions or the other kinds of questions in mass incarceration. So I feel pretty good about this, but I think that we need a lot more, and we certainly need a lot more public understanding, as we've had from some of the callers this morning.
Let's take a call next from Ellen, who's calling us from Milwaukee. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am a retired attorney from Wisconsin and Illinois, And I did about 35 years of criminal defense work. And my problem is, at least in Illinois and Wisconsin, is it really takes 7 or 8 contacts before someone is put into a prison. And during that time, they've had a lot of interaction with private and state social service agencies that, quite frankly, are totally ineffective. And it's I don't think it's a question of money at that point. It's a question of simply not getting a good result and keep trying the same things over and over again. And I think that's one of the issues that has to be addressed is how do we get these young offenders or pre-offenders when they're 12, 13, or 14, and they're not going to school, they're involved in distribution of drugs, and they don't have any family. And that is really the groups of people that end up in prison that I experienced during my time.
We're almost out of time. A quick response, Peter Edelman?
Well, he's talking, the caller's talking about the overall criminal justice system, and of course, unfortunately, there's a lot of truth to that. A lot of that relates to poverty, and some of it relates to the way the criminal justice system works. I'm talking about here a particular thing, which is really about things that are basically not crimes at all, and that are or should be minor kinds of things with a $50 fine or something like that instead of a $500 fine. And you have I'm sure the caller knows, some parts of Wisconsin, some parts of Illinois, smaller communities particularly, where they really do go after people for things that aren't what the caller was calling about. These are people who are not really criminals at all, and they just get trapped in these fines and these horrendous fees. So let's differentiate there between the general problem that we have, which is a tremendous challenge to get it right, and this particular problem, which is a national problem on the fines and fees.
Do you think there's and this will have to be the last question, I hate to leave it on this, but it's an important one. Do you think we have the political will to replace all of those fines and fees with the kind of tax revenue that municipalities and cities and states used to have?
I think at the moment it will be state by state, in some cases maybe even city or county, and we see that in some places. But yes, we need overall, over a longer period of time, a different kind of attitude among the public for paying for the things that we need as a country and not doing these kinds of things, and that is a challenge. We need a different politics, and that's not simple.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Peter Edelman, thank you so much for sharing this hour with us.
Thank you very much.
Peter Edelman is a professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center of Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown Law Center. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is the executive producer. Of course, coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll have the Week in Review. We'll have guests from different political perspectives discuss and debate the top political news stories of the week, and it should be a full and exciting hour. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 8 for the Week in Review. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.